This is a lecture tape for November 10th, 1999, and we're finishing the story of Samson the judge now, and this is Judges chapters 15 and 16. We began our story last week with the announcement of the birth of Samson by a theophany. We talked about that is Jesus prior to his birth, the pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. He comes in the form of the angel of the Lord, and he came to Samson's mother, who was barren, and announced that she was to have a son, and he was to be a Nazarite, which is one set apart for God all of his life, even prior to his birth. They named their miracle son Samson, which meant little son, S-U-N, and we found that he grew in body and strength until it was time for him to marry. Samson had quite a bit of freedom to roam around, we saw, even though the Philistines were oppressing. And he went down into the area of Timnah and saw a Philistine woman there that he wanted for his bride. And we saw how he went to his parents and said, "Go get her for me," which was opposite to what it would normally be, where the father would choose a bride for the son. And then we left with the wedding. It was a seven-day feast, and part of the wedding was to have entertainment in the form of riddles. But Samson took that entertainment a step further. He had a riddle that only he could answer, and he made a wager with that riddle, saying that if they answered it, that he would give them 30 garments, and if they could not, that they were to give him 30 garments. Well, after about the fourth day, they found out they couldn't solve it, so they go to his new bride and say that if she doesn't find out the answer, they're going to burn down her home and her father and herself in it. So she whines and complains, finally gets Samson to give her the answer to the riddle, to which she passes on to the guests. So when it is solved, he says, "If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have known the answer." So he knows that they had gone to his wife, and in anger, he storms off to Ashkelon, kills 30 Philistines, takes their clothing, pays off his wager to the guests, and then storms home. At that point, the bride's father doesn't want him to leave his daughter at the altar, essentially, and so she is given in marriage then to the best man. So that's where our story left off last week, and we pick up in chapter 15 with several months later at the end of the wheat harvest, which was probably May or early June. Samson's anger finally has subsided, and he starts thinking about his wife. We talked about the type of marriage that they had, where the wife remains at the home of her parents, and the husband is considering a visiting husband. And whenever he comes to see his wife, he does so bearing gifts. And so Samson gets the appropriate gift, which is a baby goat, and he goes to visit his wife. When he arrives, he tells his father-in-law he's going on to see his wife, but the father-in-law prevents him from doing this. I'm sure he's hemming and hawing and talking about all different things, and finally he has to admit that Samson can't go into his wife because he's given his wife to his best man in marriage. He tries to justify his action by saying, "Well, I thought you hated her," which is technically, "I thought you divorced her because you left and you were so angry." But since he's already paid the bride price, which he would have had to have done before the festivities, the father-in-law then offers the younger sister to Samson in place of his wife. Well, Samson refuses the offer and vows, "I have a right to get even." He'd been wronged. He has no more further obligation to his father-in-law now, and so he's about to take revenge. I had to wonder what his father-in-law was thinking at this point. I mean, here's this incredible, strong man. What is he going to do? Well, Samson goes out, and he catches 300 foxes. The Hebrew word for foxes and jackals are exactly the same, and both of them were around in that area and still exist today. Most of the commentaries felt that it was jackals. Foxes are solitary animals. To get 300 of them would have been really difficult. Jackals are more docile, and they travel around in packs. But with Samson's strengths, he could have done whatever he wanted. So he gathers 300 of these animals together, and he ties them tail to tail in twos, and then he puts a torch between them and lights it and sends them off into these fields that have just been harvested and are now drying in the sun. And of course, you can imagine the terrified animals. They just run every which way, setting on fire these wheat fields, which in turn blaze up and hit the vineyards, and they in turn blaze all the way into the orchards of the olive trees. This was a common method of retaliation or revenge used in the ancient world because agriculture was their main source of both food and income. So by setting their fields and their orchards and their vineyards on fire, you basically made them helpless. Well, now the Philistines are outraged and they want revenge. Look at verse 6. When the Philistines asked who did this, they were told, Samson the Timnite, son-in-law, because his wife was given to his friend. So the Philistines go up and burn her and her father to death. It was easier for them to attack Samson's wife and her father than it was to go ahead and get Samson. What I found so ironic about this, all of this started with a threat to burn down her home with her and her father in it. That's how the riddle got started. That's how the wager and how he'd gone off to Ashkelon and killed everybody because they had threatened. And now we find that that threat was very real and it came to pass anyway. Well, now Samson finds out the Philistines have killed his wife, so he wants counter-revenge. Look at verse 7. Samson says to them, since you have acted like this, I won't stop until I get my revenge on you. And so he attacked them viciously and slaughtered many of them. Then he went down and stayed in a cave in the rock of Etam. We talked about this in the leaders' meeting yesterday, and we're not sure why he went to this rock. Samson has no fear, so I don't think he went to hiding. We wondered if he'd gone off to pout or whether he just wanted to be alone. But for some reason, he chose to go to the rock of Etam. Well, the slaughter now results in 1,000 Philistines assembling to go look for Samson. And they come into the area of Judah, the tribe of Judah, and they camp in the valley there. In verse 10, the men of Judah asked, why have you come to fight us? And they say, we've come to take Samson prisoner, to do to him what he did to us. Then 3,000 men from Judah go down to the cave at the rock of Etam and say to Samson, don't you realize that the Philistines are rulers over us? Why have you done this to us? So now we've got Samson with 1,000 Philistines after him and an additional 3,000 men of Judah as well. And the men of Judah are afraid that the Philistines are going to take out their revenge against them because they're angry with Samson. Now keep in mind that the Philistines have been oppressing him for over 40 years and they're the most powerful dominant force in the area at this time. And so they're afraid of these vicious people. They don't want to cross them at all. It also said that the men found Samson at Etam. How they knew where he was, I don't know, but it's interesting because if the identification of this cave is correct, it's about 2.5 miles from Zoar, which is Samson's home. And in order for the men of Judah to reach Samson, they would have had to left the Philistines down in the valley, climb to the top of this rock cliff, and then start going back down the cliff face as far as they would dare to go. And then they probably had to call to Samson. In order to get to this cave, there's a fissure that only one man at a time can pass through. So it's fairly secure and safe because you can't get a lot of armies coming through that area. It's very precarious and you have to essentially be a rock climber. So they call down to Samson and they explain the situation to him and he says, okay, I'll come with you, but you have to guarantee that when I come out, you won't try to kill me. Now, he's not afraid that they can kill him, because they certainly can't, but his problem is not with the men of Judah. It's with the Philistines. And if the men of Judah tried to kill him, then he would have to come against his own people. And I think even at this point, he realizes that the shedding of his brother's blood is shedding innocent blood, and he doesn't want to be responsible for that. So they agree that they will not try to come against him, that they will only deliver him over to the Philistines. At this point, Samson now would have to climb out of the cave and climb up the rock face and get to the top of the rocks where they would bind him, in this case with new ropes, and then all of them would descend back down the rocks. Now, the men of Judah are not about to tamper with Samson. They know of his strength. I mean, there's 3,000 of them coming just to get one man. As they're descending down and coming into the valley, the Philistines find all the men of Judah with Samson bound, and it says they shout. This word actually means a battle cry. It can mean a battle cry to go and attack Samson, or it can be a shout of victory after winning a battle. But we find that when this happens, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson again in might, and he snaps those new ropes just as if they were nothing. And he grabs the nearest object, which happens to be a dead donkey's jawbone. And it's a fresh one. It's not a dried out one that would shatter, but a recently killed donkey. And he kills 1,000 Philistines with that jawbone. Now, the use of 1,000 again is rounded off, and in Hebrew it means a very large but undeterminable number. And what I found so interesting in this is there doesn't seem to be any mention of where the men of Judah went. The way I picture this in my mind, when Samson came down, they shouted and he snapped the ropes. I have a feeling these 3,000 men hightailed it back home. They weren't about to be in this battle, because if Samson was winning, which they assumed he would be, the Philistines would be mad and they might take it out on them. So they probably got out of there. There seems to be no indication beyond the fact that they delivered him that they have any part in this. In fact, it ends up to be a victorious day for Samson. He kills all of them and piles them up, and then he composes and sings his own song of victory, and he takes the credit for himself. Now, we've seen when the other judges have had great victories that songs have been written, but they always gave praise to the Lord, and they were sung as a commemorative and a way to memorize their history, and all Israel participated in it. But look at this, verse 16. He says, Samson says, with a donkey's jawbone, I have made donkeys of them. With a donkey's jawbone, I have killed 1,000 men. Then he named the place Ramah-lehi, which means Jawbone Hill, to commemorate his great victory over the Philistines with merely a jawbone. Well, following this fighting, Samson's exhausted, and he complains to the Lord in verse 18. Because he was very thirsty, he cries out to the Lord, you have given your servant a great victory. Now must I die of thirst and fall into the hands of these uncircumcised? We read, then God opened the hollow place of Lehi. The water came out of it. When Samson drank, his strength returned, and he was revived. So the spring was called En Hakkor, which means the spring of one calling, and it is still there in Lehi. Well, the chapter ends here with the word Samson's led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistine. The strength of Samson is unstoppable, and his presence has kept the Philistines in check for the 20 years that he has been marauding around, and continues to do so until his death. Now, this actually ends the story of Samson, but what we see in verse 16 is it goes back and gives us two events during Samson's life that were important. The first one is verses 1 to 3 that deals with Gaza, and then the last one deals, of course, with Delilah and the very end of Samson's life. So going back now to an event, it goes to Gaza, which is the furthest Philistine city from his home. It's about 38 miles, and he goes to visit a prostitute there. We're already familiar with Gaza. It was actually a city that Joshua captured. It's one of the main cities on the Via Maris, which is the trade route that goes from Egypt up into Asia. And it was a prime city, but when the Philistines came in, they took over it and it became one of their royal cities. We already know that Samson has great physical strength, and he seems to be unable to keep his passion under control. And we notice that the author of the book of Judges doesn't seem to cover that up at all. He just lays it out as it is and kind of documents all of Samson's exploits here. And it's believed that it brought great delight to his generation. To us, it brings great consternation, but at his time, it was a great feat of strength, and he was a superhero. We find that his reputation has spread throughout the whole Philistine nation, and so when he comes to Gaza, he's immediately noticed. Look at verse 2. The people of Gaza were told, Samson is here. So they surround the place and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, at dawn we will kill him. They begin to watch the gates for Samson. But at night, when the gates are closed, they would have gone to sleep. Now, we have to understand again in context. City gates are not simply a closing of a gate like we would think. The city gates actually contained rooms, and we learned that in the daytime that was where the elders would gather and all the legal business would take place. But in a time of battle or in the evening, the soldiers would go into these rooms in the gate and they would be there in the event that an enemy would come across and try to lay siege to the city. Once those city gates were closed, though, the city was fairly secure. These gates are huge. I mean, we're talking about 12, 14 feet high by the same width. They were very thick wood. They could be upwards of 3 feet thick. And they were lined in bronze and iron because they had to withstand siege machines. They had to withstand fire, anything that could come and make the city vulnerable. So these are very secure doors. Once they are closed, an iron bar is slid across them, and nobody can come in or go out until they're opened in the morning. So at this point, once the city gates are closed and they know Samson's still in the city, the soldiers and the men would simply go into the rooms and go to sleep, because in the morning they would open the gates and then they would lay watch for when Samson went out. But nothing can hold Samson, not even city gates. And we're told that in the middle of the night he decides to get up and go home. And since the city gates are closed, he merely pulls them off their pins, puts them on his shoulder, goes 40 miles to Hebron, and plops them down there. Incidentally, that not only was 40 miles in length, it was a 3,000-foot elevation gain. Absolutely amazing, absolutely incredible, almost unbelievable. Some of the commentaries said that maybe he just carried them out towards Hebron and plopped them down just outside the city gate. It doesn't matter. Samson had the strength to do whatever he wanted. What it did was left a very secure city completely open and vulnerable. Can you imagine their faces when they got up in the morning? I mean, it's like, what? What happened here? I can't even believe that they didn't hear this, and yet I'm sure God made sure that they slept soundly that night. Well, the last story in chapter 16 deals with the most familiar, that's Samson and Delilah. This records his last days, and we're told this time he goes down to the Zorik Valley, which is just below Zor, where the familiar cities now of Timnah and Beth Shemesh are located, and once again he falls in love with a Philistine woman. This time her name is Delilah, which means worshiper. Most commentaries believe that she was temple prostitute to the god Dagon. Samson didn't seem to have any problem with prostitutes. It could have also meant harlot or wife. But once again, we find Samson's presence is noticed. This time, verse 5 says, "The rulers of the Philistines went to Delilah." I want you to notice that the five Philistine kings have joined forces together, and they have gone and found Samson's strength, but they also recognize his weakness, his women. And so they offer her 1,100 pieces of silver if she will find out the secret of his strength. This is an incredible amount of silver, 5,500 shekels of silver. That would be 650 pounds of silver. That's buys 275 slaves with that amount. I mean, this is just an incredible amount that they are offering her. Well, Delilah uses all her feminine seductive ways to coax Samson's secrets. And you have to wonder how Samson could have been so blind to what she's doing. It seems as if his passion leaves no room for logical or common sense. She tries three times, and each time Samson gives her an answer. The first time he says, "If you tie me with 7 new bowstrings," and these would have been made out of twisted animal gut. Again, the number 7. She tries this, and of course he snaps it, and then she says, "You didn't tell me the truth." So he says, "Well, how about new ropes?" Now, the Philistines had to have already known that, because that's what they tried to bind him with when they took him out of the cave of Etam. But, again, she ties him up with new ropes, and again, he snaps those. Finally, he comes pretty close when he mentions his hair. He says, "Now, if you take my hair and weave it into a loom and tie it with a pin, then I'll be weak." This one cracks me up. How does she get him to go to sleep next to a loom so that she can weave his hair? The loom was not the laying down kind that we see today with the Indians, but it was an upright type of loom. But still, he had to go to sleep fairly close to the loom in order for her to weave his hair. But he does it. And of course, when she calls, the Philistines are coming again, he wakes up. But this time, he's not able to break the loom. He just pulls the whole thing along with him. And it's believed that these looms were anchored into the rock in the home. So this was a pretty mighty feat here. And I had to wonder who disentangled his hair now from the loom. Well, she tried three times, and each time the Philistines came rushing in when she shouted, and each time he broke free. But verse 16 seems to indicate now that there's a considerable length of time before he gives her any more information. But he continues to seek out Delilah's love, and she never gives up her quest. She's got her eye on this huge wealth. She uses the ploy, "You don't really love me," and she whines and cries, and she keeps on bugging him until finally he can't stand it anymore. And I wondered if it was the tone of voice or just maybe the way he looked at her, but look at verse 17. "So he told her everything. 'No razor has ever been used on my head,' he said, 'because I've been a Nazarite set apart to God since birth. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me, and I would become as weak as any other man.' When Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she sent word to the rulers of the Philistines, 'Come back one more time. He has told me everything.' So the rulers of the Philistines returned with silver in their hands. Having put him to sleep on her lap, she calls a man to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him. And his strength left him, and then she called, 'Samson, the Philistines are upon you.'" She knows the whole while what she's doing, and yet here she is having his head in her lap, lulling him to sleep with the thought of what was going to happen next. Up to this point, Samson has broken only 2 of the 3 stipulations. He's involved in drinking of the wine, and he's involved in touching of the dead bodies. When he breaks the 3rd stipulation, which is his hair, the final symbol of his separation to the Lord has been removed. He is no longer a Nazarite, no longer set apart for the Lord's use. Look at verse 20. "He awoke from his sleep and thought, 'I'll go out as before and shake myself free.' But he did not know that the Lord had left him." I think for me this is probably the saddest verse in the Old Testament. Samson assumed that his great strength would always be there. He was totally unaware that his strength, his real strength, was the Lord, not his hair. Well, the weakened Samson is easy to capture by the Philistines. They bind him in shackles and they gouge his eyes out, making him unable, even if his strength returns, to be able to see. And so he's brought down to Gaza and put to work at the tedious task of grinding out corn, probably at a handmill. Now, not only is this tedious and menial, but it's degrading because this is women's work. And we've already seen how these mighty men would have anything but a woman taking their strength. Of course, we remember the story of Jael and Sisera, where she put the tent peg through his temple. And, of course, Abimelech, when the woman in the tower at Thebes throws down the millstone, he says, "Quickly, kill me to the man so that it's not said that I was killed by a woman." They must have felt secure now. He's blind, he can't see, he's shackled hand and foot. And the story might have ended there, but verse 22 suggests that there's still more to come. It says, "But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved." Interesting, if you remember back to Numbers chapter 6, when a Nazarite vow was broken, they were to shave their head, and then their vow would start over, the time would start over again. Samson now spent his days in darkness. I wondered, now that he had his eyes off these women and what was going on, if maybe he focused in on the Lord. If you think to the New Testament, God got the attention of a man named Saul, later called Paul, by blinding him for 3 days. And so we find him grinding grain. We don't know the length of time, but we know at the end of a harvest, the Philistines celebrate with a thanksgiving to their grain god Dagon. Whether it was the same harvest where he had been taken, or whether it was a year later or many years later, is unknown. But this festivity included heavy eating and drinking, and at some point the Philistines decided that not only did they want to thank Dagon again for giving them their enemy, but they wanted to make sport of him. Now, this Thanksgiving was a time when all of the Philistines would gather, kind of like our Thanksgiving. And we know all the lords and the ladies were all part of this festivity, and they call for Samson to come and entertain them. And we find Samson being led in by a single lad, a small boy. Here's this mighty man Samson that the whole army couldn't capture, being led in by a small boy. We have uncovered in archaeology temples from this time period, and they believe that the Temple of Dagon was like one of these temples because they were all similar. It would be a central court which would be open, and then there would be a viewing area that would include like throne type chairs where the dignitaries would sit, and then over them would be a balcony or where the other important visitors would sit, and all of them would have a good view of the main area, and then the peons and the lesser people would sit around the edges. But the covered area there was for the dignitaries, and these balconies were held up by pillars, and they were pillars set on bases, and they were round stones, some of them marble, some of them granite, and they were stacked up. So at this point, Samson has been entertaining them, and he's tired now, and so he needs to rest. And what they do is they probably take him under this overhang so that the lords and ladies can get a better look at him. And he asks the attendant to put him between the main pillars. They would be about 6 feet apart, and the supporting pillars would be very much in the center, which is right where the kings and their ladies would be. And at that point, we come to verse 28. Then Samson prayed to the Lord. And I'm going to read this in the Hebrew so that you get the full picture. It says, Samson prayed to Yahweh, O Adonai Yahweh, remember me. O Elohim, please strengthen me just once more and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes. What we see him doing is using all three titles of God. Yahweh, the personal God of Israel. Adonai, meaning Lord and Master. Elohim, which is generic for just God, but to the Hebrews it meant the God of the universe. So he's using all three, and he's calling upon his name, asking for strength just one more time. God renews his strength, and Samson grasps hold of the two central pillars. What he actually does is pushes forward, and when he pushes forward on the pillars, they come off their base, and the balcony, which is being supported by these pillars, would come crashing down on the kings and their ladies and Samson. At that time, all of those underneath the balcony would be killed instantly. Those on the balcony, many would be killed in the collapse or else injured in the mayhem afterwards. The lords or the kings that were killed instantly were the ones that had paid Delilah, and it's believed that Delilah also was probably underneath that portico. Women were also killed, possibly because they were downfall of Samson. What it did was killed all the leaderships of the Philistine, and without the leaders, the Philistines would take a while before they could reorganize then. In the end, we see that the Philistines put aside their hatred of Samson because they allow him to be buried. This was very important in antiquity. A body that was refused to be buried was a great sign of humiliation and abuse. It appears that he was taken by relatives and buried alongside his father Manoah. Now, it says his brothers, but there's no documentation that he had any other siblings. It's believed he was an only child, so these would have been clansmen or fellow people from the tribe of Danite. We find him buried in the valley of Zorkor at his home site. During the lifetime of Samson, he was able to keep the Philistines in check, but not to defeat them. Now with his death, the Philistines are basically to encroach on Israelite hill country, but having taken the leadership out, it would take a while for them to regroup. Well, how do you put the story of Samson into proper perspective for our day? I found that thought daunting. To explain Samson seems impossible. So what I've done is given you a 2-page handout with thoughts that I've taken from some of the Hebrew scholars that are far wiser than I am, so you can read that. But as for myself, even though it's difficult to understand how God could use a man like Samson, I came to the conclusion that perhaps God's purpose for Israel at this time, in these circumstances, was best fulfilled not by an all-out war, but against the Philistines, by the hit-and-run tactic of a man like Samson. He could go openly into the cities, do considerable damage, then leave before they even knew what hit him. And this seemed to disrupt the Philistines so much that they weren't able to gather together and advance into the hill country of Israel. Ultimately, all we can say is that God is sovereign. He uses whoever he will to do what he wants, and some of them, like Samson, even in spite of them. I also saw Samson as a powerful picture of wasted potential. He could have and should have been one of the greatest men of God in the Old Testament. Even in the Philistine prison, all Samson had to do was turn his heart back towards God, and God was patiently waiting for him and returned to his servant. I also noticed that Samson seemed to compartmentalize his life. It seemed there were certain areas that are okay for God to be in, but when it came for his passion of women and the Philistines, he was kind of on his own. And he always seemed to be getting into trouble because of that. And then I wondered about us today. Do we compartmentalize our life? It's sure easy to do, isn't it? For those of us that have the privilege of being at home, it's a little easier to live our lives for the Lord. But if you're in the workforce, particularly for our husbands, it's very difficult to not compartmentalize, say, this is work and this is church and family. But God wants us 24/7. Each of us has been given a potential and a possibility, and it's our role to use it to glorify the Lord. Again, it all comes down to choices, and the choice is ours to make. This story actually ends the era of the judges. We're going to pick up the story of Israel's history again with 1 Samuel. The remaining 5 chapters of Judges are going to do just like we saw today, where Samson's life ended with chapter 15 and then 16 went back and gave us some more details. The remaining 5 chapters are going to go back and give us some details during the time of the Judges, and we're going to look at both the apostasy and a faithful remnant that is involved in the time of history when Israel was with the Judges. So I hope you enjoy. And we're going to continue on with our story of the tribe of Dan next week.